Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Tariq Ramadan arrived in the United States yesterday, 6 years late. The renowned Oxford professor of Islamic studies was on his way in 2004 to begin a job as professor of religion, conflict, and peacebuilding at Notre Dame. But the Bush administration blocked his entry by invoking a provision of the Patriot Act that keeps out people who have donated to organizations on the U.S. terrorist list. Ramadan had given about $1,300 to a group that had given money to Hamas. All that money was given before Hamas was designated a terror group by the U.S. government, but that didn't seem to matter to the administration. After years of litigation supported by the ACLU and the writers group PEN, Professor Ramadan is now allowed into the country, both because he finally won in court and because Secretary of State Hillary Clinton issued an order lifting the ban on Ramadan coming to the United States. And yesterday he arrived. Tonight, Tariq Ramadan will be in a panel discussion at the Cooper Union Great Hall in Lower Manhattan that will also include Jacob Weisberg from Slate, George Packer from The New Yorker, and others. Professor Ramadan's books, if you're not familiar with him, are mostly about the relationship between Islam and the West, with titles like Islam, the West, and the Future of Modernity, and To Be a European Muslim. He is controversial in intellectual circles over questions about whether he really means to reconcile Islam in the West or is out to promote Sharia law through Western-style intellectual engagement. And Tariq Ramadan joins us now. Professor Ramadan, thank you so much. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for your invitation.
In your opinion, what's the lesson to be learned from your struggle to re-enter the United States?
There are many lessons. The first one is, as I said from the beginning, not to confuse between a specific American administration and the people, because I got lots of support from Americans over the last 6 years, and the Bush administration now is over. So I think it's quite important not to confuse. And the second thing is really that if you stick to your principles, if you are quite clear on what you are doing, and I was from the beginning, there is nothing hidden in all what I have been doing. It's quite clear that at the end you will find solutions. So be an American, be a Westerner, be a Muslim, stick to principles, and then you will see that you can challenge wrong and wrong decision and bad suspicion.
And do you conclude for the rest of the world to see that the American justice system can work and that intellectual freedom matters in this country as a value?
I think it has a value, but sometimes, and this is what I have been saying for the last years, the most important danger for Americans or European countries is not the Muslim presence. It's because people are scared of the Muslim presence to betray their own principles and values. So the decision of banning, you know, scholars and Muslim scholars in particular is just revealing something about the state of affairs in the United States of America.
But I guess I'm asking almost the opposite question or with the opposite premise, which is that the fact that, the world turned, the Obama administration allowed you in, and the court anyway ruled in your favor, does it tell the rest of the world that intellectual freedom does matter in this country?
Yes, but as I my answer was, yes, it does matter, but it's very fragile, and we have to be very cautious in times of, you know, fear and emotional politics. You can use emotions and fears to do exactly the opposite, which is to forget about your own values.
Your exclusion from the country was for giving money to a group that gives money to Hamas. What do you think of Hamas? Do you see it as a force for liberation, a terrorist group, not serving the interests of Palestinians even very well? How would you characterize it?
Two things. First, it's not yet known if this organization was giving money, because this is not a blacklisted organization in Europe where I live. So this is something which is quite important. And then I gave, as you said, the money before it was blacklisted in the state. This is one thing. The second thing about Hamas, what I'm saying is that resistance for me, and this is what I said in the American embassy in Switzerland, the resistance to oppression and what is done by the Israeli government is legitimate. The means that I use are not. So I'm supporting the resistance. I'm not supporting the means of killing innocent people. And I would say this for all, you know, what is also happening in Iraq.
And I don't want to dwell on the Middle East because your books are mostly about the relationship between Islam and the West, with titles, as I said, like Islam, the West, and the Future of Modernity, and To Be a European Muslim. Do you see fundamental conflicts between Islamic values and those of Western liberal democracy?
No, and once again, you know, you quoted some of the titles about Western Muslims, but I have a series of books on the Middle East and Muslim majority countries because I think these are connected realities. We cannot disconnect that. So I'm also dealing with this, and I'm saying, you know, if we are not going to be serious about the Middle East, for example, it is going to be very difficult to be, you know, and to understand the positive and constructive role of Western Muslims because we are citizens. So, and citizens means that we are loyal to our country. Loyal to our country, we want the best for the American society, the best for the European countries. But the best means also to be critical when we think that the governments or the administration is doing wrong. And this is something which is, this is what I call the critical loyalty, which is, yes, I would be with you when you're right, but I will be critical when I think you are wrong. So these are Western values and they are at the same time Islamic values. So on these values, we agree.
So there's that much. But in your book, Islam, the West, and the Future of Modernity, at least
it's the challenges of modernity.
Challenges, yes. Forgive me. Yeah. I've seen this quote of you in the press. We are indeed dealing with two different universes of references, of reference, two civilizations and two cultures. So can you tell us in concise terms what those two different universes are based on as you see it and whether people who start from those two universes of reference can agree on what democracy and governance should be like?
Yes, I think that, you know, it's in my last book. I have a book which is coming, which is called The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism. I'm just using the image of a mountain. It's at the top, we have the shared common universal values, but the roots are different, and we are starting from different parts, and the valleys, there are many roots. What I'm saying is that our values, our histories and our understanding, civilization are quite different. You know, the Islamic civilization has a specific history, a specific, you know, set of or a system which is quite different. Now, when you go from the set of, and the system itself to the values, you understand that we have common values when it comes to human dignity, when it comes to justice, when it comes to freedom. We may have different roots, but we end up at the same top of the mountain. This is where, for example, when people are saying, oh, in Islam we don't have democracy, I say, look, don't use the concept of democracy without coming to the principles that are behind democracy. And they have five main principles: rule of law, equal citizenship, universal suffrage. On this principle, we agree. So we may sometimes misunderstand words, but we need to come to the principles that are common.
But many Americans will look at societies that are governed under what the rulers see as Islamic law, whether it was Taliban rule in Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Hamas in Gaza, and they will say, well, if this is the kind of government that springs up explicitly in the name of Islam, then maybe the intellectual and you know, values-driven reference point really are just too different.
So I would say you quoted many different realities, you know, you are quoting, and I think that as we are doing in the West, we have to be very, very precise and very focused. If we speak about what is going on in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or in Iran, we have to be focused. My point on all this is to be very critical and say many things are done in Muslim-majority countries in the name of Islam, and this has nothing to do with Islam. This is why I'm banned from still six, you know, Muslim-majority countries, because I'm critical of Saudi Arabia. But the point is that we are very happy to have relationship with these countries when it comes to geostrategy, geostrategic reasons and money and oil. We are happy with this. We also have to look at our own contradictions. As a Muslim, I would say they are betraying the very essence of the Islamic teachings. But it's not because of Islam. The problem is not Islam. It's about government. It's about dictatorship. It's about, you know, for example, we have secular state in Muslim-majority countries, in Egypt, in Syria. They have nothing to do with Islam, but they are still dictatorships. So we should not confuse what is happening there with, oh, this is Islam and this is because of Islam. No, it's because of power and dictators.
And different human interpretations of holy texts?
Oh yes, this is it. What I'm saying, and this is, you know, I wrote a book on radical reform is how Muslims in the contemporary world, not only in the West but wherever they are, they have to deal with, you know, contemporary issues. We have many interpretations. We have the same sets of texts, but we have many interpretations. So Muslims should accept this diversity. It goes from literalists to reformists. I'm from the reformist trend, and we have to understand this, and we have to be critical. But for all of us, ordinary citizens, as well as, you know, scholars, essentialization is dangerous. To say, oh, this is what is happening in the name of Islam, it means that Islam is this. I think that this, no one would do this with Christianity, Judaism, or even a secular ideology.
Tariq Ramadan is my guest on WNYC, professor of Islamic studies at Oxford, banned from the U.S. for the last 6 years under the Patriot Act, that now overturned in court and also, I guess, also voluntarily overturned by the Obama administration. Is that accurate to say, or were they just following the court order?
No, it's voluntarily. And I think that this is a very important political step.
And so he is in New York today for a panel discussion at the Cooper Union Great Hall tonight. That will include Jacob Weisberg from Slate, George Packer from The New Yorker, among others. And we can take a few phone calls for Professor Ramadan. Maybe some of our Muslim listeners want to call in. And if you have, well, first of all,
and anybody. Muslim as well.
Yes. other Muslim listeners. Well, you're not a listener. You're a guest. Call in and maybe you've read Professor Ramadan's work or some of it, or maybe you just want to talk about weaving that line between religious identity and civic identity, or anyone else. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you think, by the way, that the press misreports in its emphasis where you've been banned from? You just said something that I didn't know, which is that you're banned still from six other countries because of your criticism of Saudi Arabia. So is the bigger story not, oh my God, Tariq Ramadan was banned from the United States for 6 years, but rather, oh my God, Tariq Ramadan is still banned from six countries? And they're the bigger problem.
Yes, and I think that the bigger picture is very much, you know, we are speaking about the States, we are speaking about the West, we say, oh, he's controversial. We are not aware, and the Western media are not covering the fact that I am also controversial in Muslim-majority countries, not only because I'm criticizing Saudi Arabia or some regimes, because I am saying things about the way we are dealing with the Islamic principles and betraying them as something which is unacceptable.
What are those countries that you're banned in?
So my own country of origin, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, and Syria. These are the countries where I cannot go. And, you know, when I have people here saying in the United States of America, you know, be careful with him because he's very nice when he talks to you, but he has another language, another speech that he is delivering in Muslim-majority countries. My answer is just this one. If this was true, you know, I wouldn't have been banned from all these Muslim-majority countries. I'm banned from these countries because my speeches and the substance of what I'm saying is always the same. And this is why on both sides, so to speak, I'm facing people who are not ready to face critical thinking and also something which has to do with consistency in the way we deal with our values.
You are controversial in the West. There have been entire books written about you and what you really think versus what somebody else thinks you really think. Ian Baruma, writing about you in the New York Times Magazine, described your politics as Noam Chomsky on foreign policy, Jerry Falwell on social issues. How accurate do you think he is?
No, I think the point is that on anything which has to do with theology and religious thinking, he is very far from getting the point. And this is, you know, we in 3 hours and to write something which is, the way he was putting it is not accurate, I would say.
Let me go further into it, quoting one of your critics, writer Paul Berman, who describes you in his new book as speaking in a carefully crafted double ambiguity that sounds reformist to Western ears, but supportive of old world Quranic ideals in your Muslim admirers. For example, he says you regard biology education as merely an education in Western biology, which ought to be supplemented by a bit of Islamic biology. And that sounds to him like the Falwell-style argument for teaching creationism as an alternative to evolution. Is that your position?
It's completely wrong. I want this quote to come, and he's not quoting me. He is just, in fact, he's translating from French books into English. This was already said, and I've responded to this, and he's not reading my responses. I think it's not fair. It's intellectually without probity, and I would say I don't have time to waste with translators. If he's coming to talk to me about evidences, it's not this. The point for me, it's really this one. It's really, for example, what I was saying is that, you know, I have been teaching Western philosophy. I have been teaching Nietzsche, saying God is dead, and I was doing it in a fair way by saying what Nietzsche is saying and thinking. So to come to me and say, oh, he is promoting creationism, it means that he hasn't read anything that I was publishing about creationism, saying this is wrong and we don't have a problem with evolution in the Islamic teaching.
Is there something roughly translatable as Islamic biology that you think should be taught?
I never used that word. Never. There is nothing. You know, in the book, Radical Reform, I'm even saying there is nothing like Islamic economy, Islamic finance. I'm saying there is Islamic ethics in economy, and I never used Islamic biology. Islamic biology is meaningless. I never used this. It's just for me my own answer. And by the way, the last book, What I Believe, it's a very short book of all what I'm thinking about some critical and sensitive issues. And to tell you the truth, it is in fact an answer to Paul Berman, book, which is once again translating things that have been said during the last over the last 20 years. And it's a proof also that when you are not arguing, when we don't have arguments, the only thing that you say about someone, he has a double talk. We don't come with arguments, say, oh, he means something else. We know that what he thinks. How do you know this? How do you know that, you know, to say, for example, you just quoted something that I never said.
I also read that you're the bête noire of French feminists, because they see your public events that attract many veiled Muslim women, and they say that you are promoting a kind of conservative Islam that is not in women's interests.
You know what? One of my supporters in France is Christine Delphi, who was very close to Simone de Beauvoir. She is just the highest profile to, you know, the feminist movement in France. And what is more feminist than to say to the Muslims as well to the Westerner, I am for the freedom, for every single woman. You want to wear the headscarf, you wear it. You don't want, you don't. And it's Islamically wrong to impose this. But some of the feminists, some of them, not all of them, in France, they think that the only way to be a good feminist is to decide not to wear it because this is the only right feminist decision.
Do you go, though, into a critical deconstruction of what the veil means when women feel they should be wearing it?
Yes, of course, we have to do this. But if someone is telling you, after all this, and some very educated women are telling you, I'm wearing because I think that this is the way to free myself and to free my ego, you also have to listen to this. We don't only have the right answer when you say, go without veil. It could be a valuable answer, and we have to respect it.
Tariq Ramadan, my guest on WNYC, and Zubair, thank you for calling. You're on the radio.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Actually, welcome to our guest, Tariq Ramadan. My name is Zubair. I'm from New York. I have one question for the professor. Actually, recently in Switzerland, the parliament, or I don't know, the Congress, voted for the funding of the Islamic minarets. And since he's from Europe, I would like to know his point of view on this this vote by the Switzerland parliament to ban the Islamic
minarets, the banning of the minarets in Switzerland.
But it was a referendum. It was not the parliament. It was the people. You know, 67% of the people were supporting banning the minarets in this referendum.
These are structures on mosques. Is that more scary to you because it was a public referendum?
Yes, it means that there is a problem here, that we have a leading party, which is a far-right party, a populist party, using the fear. You know, we only have four minarets in Switzerland so far. And then you are saying, oh, it's the colonization of the Muslims. They are not accepting our values. And they had a flag with, you know, minarets drawn as missiles and saying, okay, this is a silent colonization. So my answer to this is what is happening in Europe. And sometimes we have this discussion in America and in Canada, is that the visible symbols of the Muslim presence are problematic, because it's as if we want Muslims, but invisible Muslims, to be respected. And I think that this is not going to make it. This is not the future. The future is for the Muslims to have their mosques, they have their symbols, while they have to take into account the surrounding culture, of course, the taste. And even we don't have to build mosques with our Oriental taste. We can do it with Western taste, and this is something that could happen. But still, even in Germany, when they did this, they had demonstration in front of the mosque saying, oh, this is Islamization of Europe. So the future is for the Muslims and the Western Muslims and the Swiss Muslims to speak out, to make it understandable, to make Islam understandable, to explain what they want exactly, but also for the surrounding society to get a better understanding and to have a constructive approach towards this Muslim presence. So while we have to resist populist parties by saying we are not going to let you use the fears of the people to win the next election, we have to respect the fears of the people around us and try to explain and to be proactive.
Gabriel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Tariq Ramadan. Hello, Gabriel.
Yeah, hi there. I just have a few questions to the professor that he's been really, really infuriating all of us, and he's basically a wolf wearing a lambskin. And I grew up in a Muslim country, and I have few questions to him. The first question is, the idea of having Islamic biology is just the most absurd thing. In the Hadith, which is the second book that the Muslim believes in, there is something said, the Prophet said, that if you drink a donkey's pee, that should be sufficient to heal you from any disease. Do you have an answer to that, or can you deny that this thing exists?
First thing is, once again, I never spoke about Islamic biology, and this is wrong. I never advocate that. These are things that I never said. The second thing is that, yes, we have some of the hadiths, and some of them are weak. And I can tell you that no Muslim scholar is using the hadith that you are mentioning now to promote science and biology and medicine. So let us be serious about critical questions.
Jeremy at NYU. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Thanks, Brian. Yes, Professor Ramadan, I'm really grateful that you've been able to travel to the States.
You.
Finally, I'm a professor of Islamic studies at New York University, in fact. I just wondered if you might speculate a little bit on what you see the role of the concept of the Ummah, what role you see it playing for American Muslims in the future. I think about this myself in my work.
And Jeremy, just for people who don't know, define Ummah very briefly.
Yes, the Ummah is the theological concept of the universal community of Muslims. It's not necessarily a political concept, but it has been politicized by a lot of Islamists in various contexts.
Yes, I think that your answer here by defining it is quite important. It shouldn't be a political concept. It should be a spiritual communion and a spiritual community where, as a Muslim, I'm connected to all the Muslims around the world in a kind of a spiritual communion. Now, this spiritual communion is based on principles, and the principles should be quite clear, that we are promoting justice and that we are promoting what is right and resisting what is wrong. Meaning by this, that wherever you are, you have principles and contracts and you have to abide by them. Meaning that if the Muslims are doing right, you should support them, but if they are doing wrong, you should act against what they are doing. So it means for me that for American Muslims, when you are living in this country, you abide by the law of the country, you know the language of the country, and you want the best for the future of your country. But by being here, as long as you belong to your principles. You act for what is good. This is the way you are helping the ummah. It's never, never my ummah right or wrong. And in fact, as an American Muslim, your ummah is your country. You should be able to say to the Americans, Ya Qawmi, as we say in Arabic, my people, you are my people. This is the concept of the new we. And my people, let us come together. The new we, you, Muslims, non-Muslims, agnostic, atheists, Christian, Jews, all together in the name of common principles of justice and dignity. And this is what we have to promote. This is the way I see it. And this is the way I would like the Muslims also to deal with Muslim-majority countries and not playing the victim and nurturing the victim mentalities. Or we belong to a universal community which is not liked and targeted today. So we are on the defensive. I would do exactly the opposite.
Thank you for your call, Jeremy. We are just about out of time, Professor Ramadan. I'm glad that you were able to come back into the United States.
Thank you so much.
Free speech is very important. And it looks like you were unjustly accused or falsely accused anyway, under the technical wording of the law. What do you think, before you go, of the very wording of the clause of the Patriot Act under which you were excluded, and that was that people who support or espouse terrorism, support or espouse terrorism can be excluded from the United States. Do you think it's wrong for any country to exclude from immigration or even visitor visas people who openly espouse terrorism?
I think that we have to be first, you know, the definition of terrorism is so wide and so complex that we don't have international institutions coming with a clear understanding of what terrorism is all about. For example, if you support the fact that you go and kill innocent people in Iraq, and what we know now, what happened with the American invasion there, I think that is problematic. So we have to be quite clear. When people are talking and advocating, let the people talk, challenge what they are saying. And this is when we are talking about freedom of expression. This is it. Now, when people are involved in something, which is quite different, so this is where we have to put the limit. But now, coming with this sense that when you think, or what, when we think that you think, that when maybe you are connected, and to ban the people, this is not going to be a healthy policy for the future.
Tariq Ramadan will be appearing at the Great Hall at Cooper Union tonight at 7 o'clock in a panel discussion with Dahlia Mogahed, Joan Wallach Scott, and Jacob Weisberg. I also had George Packer. Do you know if that's accurate or inaccurate?
I think so, yes. Yeah,
George Packer, yes, from The New Yorker. It will be called Secularism, Islam, and Democracy, Muslims in Europe and the West, presented by the American Association of University Professors, the ACLU, and the Pan American Center, as well as Slate. And listeners, if you're interested in that event, without going to it, WNYC's Culture Department will be recording that panel tonight, and it will be available afterwards on our website at WNYC.org. Professor Ramadan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn next on the last-ditch effort to save St. Vincent's Hospital. Also, she has a few things to say about gays and lesbians filling out the census. Stay with us.